Blog Talk Radio. All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Continue Mission. I'm your co-host tonight, Rich Kilblaine, your regular host, James McCormick. He's on the road. We have reversed roles. Last week I was on the road, and now it's his turn. He'll be joining us about 30 minutes into the show. We have our regular guest on tonight, Father Michael Pacella. And so how are you doing, Father Michael?
Doing great, Rich. It's great to be back with you and James, and looking forward to our conversation tonight.
Yeah, you were out of town. Oh, no, you had, it was your wife's birthday last week?
Yes, it was her big 70th. So we had family coming, our children, and we had a great weekend of festivities. It was an excellent time.
Yeah, I saw the photos posted on Facebook. Nice little family reunion. I had a family reunion too, but for more unfortunate circumstances. My mother had passed away last February, and because of the COVID, we waited until this week, last week, to finally bury her ashes. And we were actually surprised at the number of people who wanted to travel great distances to be there, okay, which is a testament, again, to, the effect my mother had on other people, which I assume is the same with your wife, okay? That's why people showed up. Okay,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, tonight's show is about UFOs, all right? And I'm just going to be quite honest. I am an informed person on this subject, but not a well-informed person on this subject. And when James and I discussed it, you know, I told him, I said, I'm not an unbeliever. I'm really more like, my position is the same as the government, all right? There's something out there. There's a lot of flying stuff around we can't explain, and I think that's why they came up with the term unidentified flying objects, okay? Because they fly, and nobody can right now tell what they are. And until they figure it out, they're just going to be called UFOs, which they could come from these sources. We'll talk about that. There are no guarantee that they are not evidence for life in other planets. You're going to need a lot more information out there to convince us. We're going to look at the facts. Okay. This is, I guess, the reason James picked this topic has been all over the news. The government has released, the Department of Defense has released a report on this. There has been a number of videos that have been leaked that are they raise questions. They raise a lot of questions. Okay, and I'll point out that I lived in Roswell, New Mexico, for a year, and the UFO Museum, or I don't know what they call it now, in its infancy, they did a very good job of telling the story of the flying saucer crash in Roswell. Outside, there was an Air Force base there, and that that supposedly there was three bodies, longest evidence. And we may talk, I'll talk a little bit about that probably later in this show, all right? So I guess what I'm going to just go ahead and reiterate about what basically it says, yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there we can't explain, but we don't know the source. And it could be a number of things. These sightings are recorded. They're recorded through videos. They are occurring around military bases. And in fact, really, really a lot of the when I listened to what the Roswell Museum was bringing up, and they basically pointed out that there's always been claims of visitation from alien planets all throughout history. But the real increase began around, I think, it was after World War II. And I think they cited, or they explained it really kicked off after they detonated the nuclear bomb. And that's probably when aliens began to take notice and pay attention to us, okay, because we had tapped into a whole new source of energy. And that's why they're basically investigating, watching our paces and things like that. That's the hypothesis, or one of the hypotheses that, they presented, okay? But the DOD, the Department of Defense is essentially saying these could be anything. These could be Russian spy technology that we haven't quite figured out. It could be balloons floating around in the stratosphere. And keep in mind that the jet stream is real fast. Any number of things. But, just because you see something flying out there and you can't explain it, it's at high speeds that our technology can't achieve, or erratic behavior that our technology can't achieve, doesn't mean it comes from another planet or another universe. Okay, it could be. It's a possibility, but there is no other evidence to indicate that. Okay, so Michael, what have you heard? What's your comments on that?
Well, I know for one thing, we're not alone. And I know that there are intelligent beings. Now, as regards, some of the aircrafts and things of that nature, I think it's interesting because when the disciples saw Jesus walking on the water, they thought it was a ghost. And then when Jesus appeared to them, he had to convince them that he wasn't a ghost, and that's why he asked them if they had something to eat. And, the church has unfortunately made different declarations in the past that have made it seem as if it were unscientific. So I'm with you. I'm agnostic in the sense that I believe that there could be, the universe is so great. I've studied some astronomy.
Right.
I have some friends that are actually cosmologists, they're PhDs in science. Matter of fact, I met with one of them yesterday. And when you begin to contemplate how vast the universe is and how great God is, I don't know that we could make a resolute statement. Now, the Bible doesn't speak specifically. Unfortunately, like in Ezekiel 1, there's a wheel within a wheel, and people have let their imagination run away, not sanctified imagination, and they were saying these are spaceships and that. But I think it's a very interesting thing. I think there are higher powers, more intelligent beings. I would say that they're angels and principalities and thrones and dominions, things we've learned about from Scripture. But I think that we need to consider, now, if we're going to talk about salvation, did Jesus die for any other people? Did he come to any other people? We don't know that. We just know our own encounter with God. So, and I saw the videos I mentioned to you earlier. We traveled from Vietnam to the Philippines, 725 miles, and this sailor saw a lot of sea. And, I can imagine it's really dark out there, and I can imagine, how some of these people have felt, some of these pilots. I've heard their excitement. And so I'm really excited about talking about it with you. I think there are so many mysteries in the universe that we have no idea about. And I think that we need to probe, not beyond what God wants us to understand. You know, when we've talked about necromancy and some of the things that we need to stay away from, but I think this is just a curiosity about our vast universe. So I think that there are a lot of probing that we can do together, both from a spiritual perspective and a scientific one as well.
Well, you just outlined the path that I'm wanting to take the show until James gets on. Is one is, what does science say the odds of intelligent life on other planets? And then what does the Bible say about it? And then in particular, was it, because, you know, when they talk about ancient aliens, I mean, the History Channel has now become the UFO channel. Every now and then they'll have a good history documentary or miniseries, but for the most part, it's ancient aliens. And one of them they like to cite is, was it Ezekiel who was taken up by a chariot?
Elijah. Yes.
Elijah. Okay. And they like say that because there's the description of that vehicle is so detailed, they like to say that was an alien aircraft. Okay. Well, so we'll, you know, we can save that for later.
That's really interesting though, Rich. That's very interesting. The chariot of fire. That is interesting.
Okay. Well, anyway, the thing I'd like to point out is why the Bible is rather mute on this subject of intelligent life on other planets, probably other civilizations, is the focus of the Bible is rather narrow. The Old Testament focus is really the Jews. It's about them. It's a promise to them and the fulfillment of that promise. And then the New Testament is about a new message, okay, to the world, right? So that's why you can read into it, you can look for it, but keep in mind, the focus of the Bible, the authors of this, they had a message, okay? And it wasn't to explain the universe. In fact, it's interesting because there's a couple times where, you know, a couple of scriptures in the New Testament, I think it's John 3:11, when asked, one of the Pharisees asked Jesus, you know, how to enter the kingdom of heaven, and he says, you know, you have to be born again. And of course he questions, like, he's thinking in the physical term, that how can I fall back into my mother's womb? And Jesus' response is, if you can't understand when I talk about earthly things, how can you comprehend when I talk about heavenly things? So the kingdom of heaven is much more complex than we can probably understand, that our mind can comprehend. And then in Acts, you know, Jesus, there's the passage where it says, you know, after he's revealed himself, he spends 40 days teaching the apostles about the kingdom of heaven, okay? But none of the apostles write about the kingdom of heaven. There's two things there. So the focus of these scriptures is more earthly, all right? Not the universe, okay? All right,
can I pick up one thing from Elijah? You said something really interesting, because Elisha is praying for his associate, and he's saying, God, open his eyes so he can see some of the unseen realities. So in some sense, they are alien to us. They weren't humans. He was saying that there were more for us than against us, and there were spiritual horses and, you know, spiritual armies and things of that nature. So there is a realm that we can't comprehend, but it's there. And in this case, it's ready for battle.
Yeah, that's not an alien.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that he saw something that wasn't natural, and it helped him to see.
Now, of course, the UFOers are probably going to say, "Well, because if they don't believe in the spiritual realm, then that had to be physical. So therefore,
right.
he was. So what's the evidence that he was really seeing aliens from other planets?
There was someone coming to help them with the battle. And in the same way that you said about Elijah, you know, God takes him up in a fiery chariot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's awesome. You know, that wasn't something that was built in Jerusalem. You know, that was a means that was supernatural, and it could be visibly seen. But the other prophets kept kind of mocking Elisha and said, oh, you know, your master got dropped on one of the mountains. And he knew what was going on. Of course, he had that promise about the mantle that if he saw him when he went up. But what I'm trying to say is that there are other intelligent beings that do interact with us. And we call them spiritual, perhaps. And although I've read some stuff where there's been sightings, they had their head out the window or whatever, most of it has been mysterious and maybe beyond our own capability of understanding, even technologically.
Okay. You are currently holding Bible study on the book of Joshua, all right?
Correct.
Which happens to be one of my favorite books because it is, if you look at it as a military historian, what you see is a campaign plan. I mean, seriously, I don't, other than God gives a promise to Moses and doesn't allow Moses to cross the river, but he fulfills that promise through Joshua. I'm like, yeah, through a whole lot of killing. Okay.
Right.
And everything in there fits the description of the elders' tactics. That's the thing that always intrigued me. But the thing I always like to point out is, remember, God promised to Moses that he would send somebody, like an advisor, to them. And if you I want to hear your take on that. This may be a little off track. You know, how would it fit in the UFOs or alien presence? It's because it's a physical description. It's not spiritual.
Right.
This guy, that, you know, that advisor, when he approaches Joshua draws his sword and challenges him.
Right.
And
right.
The man responds, "I am an angel, the host of the Lord. This is hallowed ground.
Right.
Take your sandals off." Okay.
Right.
All right. He had no wings. He had no flaming sword. Joshua saw him as another soldier.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he challenged him. Okay. I want to hear your explanation. Now, my take on that is that is a predecessor of special forces. Okay. That God has these special forces advisors he sends down here. And if you're at SF, the joke is he stays for 159 days, disappears, and then he's followed by an angel, the host of the auditing committee, to verify all his hand receipts. But anyway, I digress. How do you explain that? How do you explain that angel, the host of the Lord? That is the – because that's the last reference to him, and you see Joshua pulling off some really incredible – victories.
What's interesting,
could that be an alien?
Well, it could be a messenger sent from God of another world. Okay, and the interesting thing, what Joshua wants to know, you know, are you an enemy or not? And his answer is very intriguing. He says, "Neither. I'm not for you. I'm not against you." And then he represents now. You know, theologically, we would say it's a Christophany, you know, it's a you know, kind of an image of Christ and so on and so forth. But he identifies himself as a soldier, you know, as one that's ahead of the armies of the Lord. But I think that we need to recognize that there are messengers from another world that are sent to us. I think even of the Virgin Mary, when she had the angel appear to her, that's not an everyday occurrence. And I think that we have to start to put into our mindset the possibility of visitations from other worlds, and however you want to characterize them, spiritual, angels, demons, whatever, there's still an invasion. They still did not have their origin from the world. And I think in
well,
that case...
Well, in this case, I differ, but go ahead.
But in that case, I mean, I just saw it's interesting because I've been studying a lot and trying to help the people understand that it wasn't a genocide, it wasn't against one race, and all the reasons of what the Canaanites were involved in. And I've been taking a lot of pains. And so I was reading through a book, and the way they pictured this person was like a lot larger than Joshua, almost otherworldly, if you will. Not a common.
See, what intrigues me. I look at this as a historian, and first of all, there is not. You can infer that, but there is nothing. The fact that Joshua draws a sword and challenges him sees him as an equal.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't
mm-hmm.
look different physically from any. He doesn't look like our normal depiction of aliens. Okay, he looks like a man.
Right.
And we've had that discussion about how God uses people, gives them a message to go and deliver. I believe this guy was an Assyrian. He was a professional soldier. He was sent
mm-hmm.
by God. You know. Because all the descriptions of angels are not, yeah, they give a physical description, but there's something alien about them, you know, wings, whatever. This guy had none of that.
And even Jesus' glorified body, the glorified body, there are many times that they didn't recognize him. Some reason that you can not distort, but even Mary
mm-hmm.
didn't recognize those on the road to Emmaus. So there's something... You know, you think of the Transformers. There's something different about a higher being than there is. That's why we talk about how Satan transforms himself into an angel of light. So there's a transforming ability. So I'm wondering, with some of these UFO sightings, if that might not be some of those transforming abilities that are beyond our comprehension that we perceive as technology, but may not be so. You know, pilots, they're like, wow, man, you see that thing? That went so fast. And, you know, it's been interesting.
Well, you just triggered some memories of some of the discussion about, you know, not the aliens, not just the UFOs. But I think we had a discussion about apparitions, and the thing
mm-hmm.
is that when these visions come, as you described in the Old Testament, and even those that have happened since biblical times, they appear to the witnesses forms that they recognize. Okay,
right.
In particular, like I said, when I worked with you on your dissertation, I was really intrigued by the visions of Mary, and
mm-hmm.
and Mary always the consistency was she always appeared as a 12 or 13 year old girl, but she appeared in the likeness and of the culture that she was witnessing.
Exactly.
And see, that doesn't appear in any of the alien sightings. So there's a difference between the alien sightings of the recent times, because, I mean, and what it triggered when you said that, I'm going, oh, yeah, because, you know, the common impression of aliens is they've got these big heads, limp bodies, and big eyes, okay, and pale skin. I read a study on that, and what it pointed out is, okay, just on the same phenomenon of, you know, as angels or Mary or spirits visiting us in forms that we recognize, what they found is that we that this whether you know those the skeptics were saying this is how we see aliens if they're making it up or whatever, but there's a commonality. That's the point. All these people who are describing these aliens are describing the same people. But the big head is because, well, for them to be able to travel, we've been in, you know, to be able to travel like this and we can't, they have to be smarter. So therefore, as a product of evolution, they have to have bigger brains. And they're, see, as our knowledge of physics or space increases, we realize, well, with weightlessness, there's absolutely no need for real muscles for travelers. The brain is a good one, and, you know, you just need to know how to manipulate the, you know, move around without, in fact, that's one of the problems in space travel is atrophy of muscles, you know, and that they, and also the loss of bone density. Okay, so the speculation on the pattern of these aliens is based on how we perceive they would look. Okay, but still, how do you explain the fact that all these people who have claimed to have seen aliens all describe pretty much the same look, which goes back to the Roswell crash. Because supposedly there was three aliens in there, and not all of them were ditched. And so some people who claimed to have seen them and seen them dissected, just, you know, and who knows, maybe it was from that description everybody else just began to copy it or expect to see it in that, you know, see them look like that, okay? But the fact is the alien sightings do not match with, you know, the visions or the visitations in the Old Testament. Your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that real interesting. And I think that if we were to see some monstrous thing, you know, let's say moving toward our home, whether or not they're made of flesh and blood, we probably would still try to defend ourselves. Now, to believe that there's greater intelligence, I mean, God is vast. I have no problem believing that, you know, a creature could be created. But I personally believe that'll happen to us as we go on in eternity. But I have no problem believing that there can be much, much more intelligent beings that are created beings, but nonetheless, perhaps more developed. And, you know, there's not a whole lot, just like you've talked about many times with near-death experiences, we have the data and there are similarities that people share. So we're kind of deducting, okay, well, they said that, they saw that. But, you know, it's like the elephant. You go into the tent, there's no light, and you describe the elephant. Well, one person touched its tail, the other person touched its trunk, the other person touched its ear. And obviously, just like the four Gospels, you want to put all that together and try to come up with some better understanding, I think, without allowing our imagination to run with us. Because, you know, when you and I grew up, you know, with all the comic books and all the, you know, speculative things. And you mentioned science before. See, I'm really interested in what we have the capacity of detecting. Now, we don't know about language. You know, we don't know about communication, curiosity. There's a lot of different things. But I don't think it's outside of the realm of God. But it should give us pause, just like when I studied astronomy. It makes me see God so much greater. When I start to contemplate the universe, the galaxies, and so, I mean, it would be pretty phenomenal. But I think that it would be important for us, just like your research with the near-death experiences, to begin to extrapolate similarities so we could build a case with real evidence and not just speculation. Important that, you know, we really seriously bring all of this data together, and that the government is not secretive, and that since we're all in this together, that the government would reveal what's been concealed and let us know so we could do the scientific deduction to see what we're dealing with.
So now you're opening a can of worms there, because the government is secretive, but the question is like, you know, especially like with Roswell, which was in the 40s, I can't remember how late after World War II it was, that, you know, supposedly they had a whole UFO. They had a flying saucer and the bodies.
Right.
And there's discussion that Area 54 has used that technology to develop like stealth fighters, bombers, and other things. But how come we haven't been able to, you know, in well over 50 years? I mean, we're probably talking like 70 years now to master this technology and actually reveal it, you know, start letting people know. It's like enough time's passed, we can talk about it. I could understand during the Cold War, we didn't want to share it. We definitely, you know, because we're looking for any edge that we could have over those Reds, you know, the communists, that we didn't want to share any of this technology, okay? I think the Cold War was won, and we're you know, everybody is sharing the space station. So I think, you know, it would logically make sense that we would probably share some of this technology.
Well,
but anyway, there was something you said. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, think about, you know, the 50s, the late 50s, and the progress we have made in that realm. I mean, just in our lifetime. And I just think that for the country, especially if there is a danger in us being invaded, for them to conceal for whatever reason, not to frighten people or whatever reason, is really a lack of integrity, because if something should happen, we all need to be alerted as to what we're dealing with. And so, you know, recently I know there's been some revelations of things that weren't shared before. And I understand technology. I understand you don't want to show yourself, you know, so fearful. And I don't know what message we're trying to send to some of the other big countries. But it would seem to me to be irresponsible if the government was concealing information in the event that we were attacked.
Well, I can understand during the Cold War, we would definitely want to conceal this knowledge and not share it with our adversaries, okay?
Right.
But there comes a point where a lot of this technology, or, you know, we're talking about code breaking and all these other things, becomes obsolete. And usually 35 years is the magic number, and that's when they go, okay, now you can talk about it. All this stuff you are not allowed to talk about during, you know, after World War II or after Vietnam, was 35 years. Now you can talk about it, right? Well, the Roswell crash is one thing that that's never brought to light, okay, which has raised some doubt in me. Anyway, when I go back to the Roswell crash, to me what was convincing was the attempt to cover it up. You know, when an officer who describes, he brings home, you know, metal that folded, you know, he brings home some of this stuff, and he describes the writing. And then the next day he changes the story. He says, oh, it was a weather balloon, okay? Mm-hmm. And when they look at, now, that everything definitely pointed to a government cover-up because I'm aware of how the government covers things up.
Right.
The fact that so much time has gone by, it's like if it was true, by now, 70 years later, they should finally release this information and share it, because in this, we're not in a space race anymore. We're sharing. And if anything, we would probably want to start, if we haven't broke the code on this technology, maybe we should have been sharing with others. But the fact that over 70 years have gone by and we have not, opened up about the Roswell crash, now to me sheds doubt that it was what people claim it was. Okay? But now there was something you were saying, and I was unfortunately muted at the time. That I want to respond to is, okay, so alien sightings. There are lots of alien sightings. But they are not considered proof. Okay? As I point out, it's my position. I'm open-minded, but I'm a skeptic. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I believe there is potential for life on other planets, and that's something we hopefully will get around to discussing, the probability of it. But the sightings. So there's a lot of people claiming they have been visited and they have seen alien visitors, and they describe them, but does the government believe them? And yet we have people who have seen angels, who have been visited by Jesus, God, and we talked about the out-of-body, the near-death experience, and the apparitions of Mary. But the Catholic Church has a method validating those?
Verification,
yeah. Okay, so the Catholic Church has a method for verifying those, whereas I don't think that exists. There's official verification for alien sightings, okay? Do you want to describe that?
I'm wondering, as you're discussing, why the government would feel that it was necessary. Now, if there are other countries that have greater technology that we're not aware of, for whatever reason they want to have the upper hand in that, but I just don't understand the logic of why, you would have information and you would keep it from the populace, since we would all be affected if something was discovered. Also, we went to the moon. We didn't find anybody. I don't think we found plant life. They brought back rocks. We've had, some discovery as far as Mars is concerned. We certainly have the powerful telescopes, Hubble, other things of that nature. And if these things were really visible in the planets that we can observe, I would have thought that by now, especially when we went to the moon, we landed there, we walked around, or we took that little go-kart or whatever. And so that gives me a little pause. Obviously, the sun's not going to have any life on it. Nor would we ever have the capacity to go find out. But does that give you any pause, the fact that the moon didn't seem to have any apparent life? And, and it's not like we just went for 5 minutes. We've done a number of different experiments there looking for life.
Well,
what are your thoughts there?
Okay. Now you're talking about something I am well informed in. I'm not a physicist, so I can't describe this in their language, but I can discuss it in lay language. All right. You want to know what that first trip to the moon taught us? That the moon is not made of green cheese.
Right, right. Yeah, that's right. And there wasn't a man on the moon either.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Seriously, I mean, you described it. We went to the moon expecting to find life. Now we know that no such thing could even exist on the moon. See, that has caused us to reevaluate what is the potential for life. Let's just say life, not intelligent life, but just life, growing organisms complex cells on other planets. It's in an infinite universe, that number, that potential is getting narrow and narrow with every time we discover something new. And so what we realized is, okay, not just with the visitation of the moon, but also the visitation to Mars, the rovers we had on Mars. Okay, we now know that, Mars lost its atmosphere because, that rotation of the core, which, on our Earth creates a magnetic field that protects us from the solar winds. Okay, it bounces them around us. And when that spinning of the core pretty much slowed down or died, it no longer produced a magnetic field, and so the solar winds pretty much just blew the atmosphere away. And all of a sudden we're realizing how fragile, life is, as we explore the moon, we're finding that, wow, there's similarity between the rocks there and our rocks. And we're beginning our knowledge of the universe and how it's created is growing. We began to understand how the moon was created. And,
Do you know the concept anthropic coincidences?
No, I don't know the term.
You know what that is?
If you describe it, it might jog my memory.
Yeah, I have a lot of scientist friends. I was their chaplain. I taught them Dante and encyclicals, but I learned a lot from them. But this is something I discovered and talked a little bit about, and I'm not a scientist, but evidently our Earth, of a degree, it wouldn't be inhabitable. And so when I'm listening to you describe, the moon and different things that you were talking about, magnetic and so on and so forth, it is kind of miraculous that our planet can be inhabited, because if it was off an inch of a degree, it would not be inhabitable. So there's something very special about that. Now, even with water, mountains, things that they've tried to, discover, as they've looked into the moon and Mars, but it's interesting. Our Earth seems to be, or our planet seems to be, special in its placement. So therefore, it can be inhabited. But they tell me that if it were just off a little bit, we would not be able to breathe and life would not be able to exist. Now, that's a layman's understanding of the anthropic coincidences. But I find that interesting in light of our talk about Mars and the moon.
Yeah, okay, and I want to point out, we're not scientists. I'm a trained historian.
No,
you're a theologian. But what we can do is we can try to explain some of this science in lay terms. Okay, if I can understand it, you can too. That is the key element right here, is as our knowledge grows, what does it take for life to exist? We conclude it requires water. It requires water. And so a planet, I was looking it up today, there are over 2,000 3,000 identified, confirmed planets in the universe, or in our galaxy, excuse me, 2,000
right.
confirmed planets in our galaxy, and another 4,000 waiting for confirmation. So we know
wow.
the planets exist. We knew the probability, but now the Hubble Space Telescope
yep.
has been able to allow us to have much more detailed vision of these stars. Now, the thing we realize is the conditions, what we're assuming now is the conditions have to be absolutely right. So we're going to say
yes.
So we're saying all life requires water. So it can't be too hot because it will evaporate, or too cold, it will freeze. So therefore,
right.
it can, the life, planets can only support life if they're a certain distance from the sun. And
right.
not any star. There are some stars. Look, they already know that our sun is heating up, and before it dies, it's going to expand and engulf the Earth. Before it ever gets there, it's going to burn away. We're talking maybe a billion years. It's going to burn away all life on Earth. All right. So, for
the Bible
life,
says that about fire.
Yes. Okay. Fire from the sky. Yes. All right. So, but the point is, we've got all these stars out there, but some of those stars are so hot that they would kill any life that would try to exist if there was a planet. One is the gravitational force would be so great it would even not even allow planets. That's another thing. The bigger
mm-hmm.
the bigger the star, the more gravitational pull it has, and it would suck all those stars into its core. All right. So it has to be the right kind of star, a small star. And the planets that form, it has to be a planet that is the right distance. For example, they refer to Venus as our sister planet, but it
mm-hmm.
is way too hot. The temperature on Venus is hot enough to melt lead. So therefore, no life can exist there, all right? And as we pointed out, Mars is probably the planet that next closest to supporting life, except we found out that when its core quit spinning, it lost its magnetic field and its atmosphere blew away, okay? But it
wow.
could probably, support, we could build these little igloos and things like that, these domes. And there's talk about, we might be able to, you could create atmosphere, but what's to hold it there? Okay. And we talk about how solar winds can just wipe out life. All right. So, one of the things we've learned is, because first of all life requires what we thought for a long time was sunlight. All energy is drawn from the sun until we started exploring these underwater volcanoes in the depths of the ocean, and we found thermal vents, and we found life was teeming around them. And it's so deep in the ocean that no sunlight penetrates it. And here's the proof that life can exist, complex life can exist
mm-hmm.
without the sun and in a very cold environment. And so, for example, there's one of the moons around, I believe, Neptune, that they look at it and they see it's frozen. But they see all these cracks in it. And I think they've even seen vents that they believe there are underwater volcanoes in there, and they believe, based on what we know about, these thermal vents in our ocean, that if that exists, then life could exist on that planet. But it, and it could be complex life too. All right.
Right.
Now, I was reading something about. Okay, now we start talking about intelligent life.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We've had several mass extinctions on this Earth. I'm an amateur paleontologist. I have loved that subject. I'm a fossil collector, and I wouldn't know anything about it. And my real interest, because where I lived in Oklahoma, was the Permian period, which was the greatest mass extinction. In fact, the area I was digging, I could point to the point of I could show you the change in the color in their sedimentary rock when it goes from either gray or a yellow limestone to this purplish sandstone, and I'm like, that is the extinction of life right there. You will find no fossils above that line right there. Now, for a long time, we're trying to figure out what caused that mass extinction, and now studies volcanism, massive volcanization in Russia, basically wiped out life on Earth.
Can I interject something?
Go ahead.
Yeah, when I studied science and theology at Cambridge, before I went there to do the PhD, in theology, and there were Christian evolutionists, as they would say, or they may have not been evolutionists, brilliant, brilliant scientists. You know, Cambridge is known for that in England and around the world. But they taught us about the Cambrian explosion. It's a different concept than evolution itself. And I just think that there's so many things. And I had a physics professor. He's a believer, PhD, went to Princeton, this and that. He gave me a video that I showed to my students at a Christian university. And I just think that even when we look at life on our own planet and levels of intelligence and instinct, and even among the human species, I mean, there are some people that are brilliant, you know, and they have, you know, photostatic, you know, memories and so on and so forth. And I just think that all that we're probing today, you know, just shows the great mysteries and the great grandeur and splendor and magnificence of the universe. And I think that because the universe is orderly, this is why you get people like Isaac Newton and other people, they said we can study science because God created. It's not arbitrary. So you're saying some excellent things, Rich, about, you know, what makes a planet inhabitable and heat, because there's rhyme or reason to life. And we don't know everything. We don't know everything in the whole universe or the galaxy, but we know something about the stars that have died and, you know, how old our planet is. I mean, we know some things. And I just think this whole deducting will help us to provide necessary evidence, even if it's concealed by the government, whether or not that's even possible, unless the species is so different than ours that it doesn't meet the same criteria of habitation.
Well, where I wanted to go with this is to show you how fragile life is. And see, when this study began, they said, okay, all right, so we're beginning to narrow it down. So there's a high probability that there are planets, other planets, and they orbit stars. Well, as our knowledge increases, okay, so we're saying all life requires these conditions. And so it narrows down the planets. It has to be a particular size star, like our sun, and it has to be a certain distance from the sun to be able to,
right,
where either the water is not going to freeze, nor is it going to evaporate away, or it's going to cook life. So now, based on that, if that planet, the odds is, then we would just automatically assume that life would naturally evolve into us, okay? And this is what I want to get at. So when you talked about the Cambrian explosion, see, before the Cambrian period, it was, I forgot the name of that period, but it was just, you know, single-cell organisms and things like that. But all of a sudden, mm-hmm. life expanded. And see, what happened after the Cambrian extinction was that life on Earth was narrowed down to 8 families, if I'm not mistaken. It was 8 families. But during the Cambrian explosion, there was more than 8. There was a great diversity. And so for Darwinists, they're going, this is an incredible period to study because this is all these competing organisms, and they will form the families, the foundations of the family, or the ancestors, the families that will populate the Earth today. All life descends from these 8 families. Well, there were winners and losers. And the question is, what caused some to win and some to lose? And some of it is just accidents of nature. Okay. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when I talked about that Paleozoic era, which is, you know, from the Cambrian period to the Permian period, most of life is in the ocean. And the other thing you need is oxygen. Some planets mm-hmm. don't have oxygen. In fact, I think the oxygen, the atmosphere of Venus is carbon dioxide, all right? Well, our Earth was too. In fact, remember, there was a period where our Earth was, it was hot, it was nothing but vulcanization, and it was basically on fire. All we had was, in fact, they think that a lot of the oxygen that was produced was actually expelled by volcanoes, but it was wind. We had algae form and then plants produce. And so life begins in the ocean. It produces oxygen. Living organisms like, you know, complex cells need oxygen. And so you have algae produces that. Once there's enough oxygen produced in the ocean, it begins to begin to grow on the Earth, produce oxygen, and life then comes out of the water. And by the end, by the time you get to the Carboniferous period, that's when you have the birth of amphibians, and then with the Permian period is reptiles. And so this early period, the world is dominated by lizards and salamanders, okay? And then you get wiped out. And it starts over. Life starts over. And then we have the Mesozoic era in which mm-hmm. we have these wonderful giant animals we call dinosaurs that are not lizards. Actually, their descendants are birds. But they're an entirely right. different species. So it isn't the age of terrible lizards. It's no, these are bird-like animals. Okay, they dominate. So for these millions of years, you've got these giants dominating life on Earth. Not man. Mammals are like rodents at this point in time. They're basically hiding from these giants with big teeth, okay? And then what happens is a meteor. Now, there are periodic extinctions. That's where almost all these, you know, when we look at geological time, how we go from the Carboniferous period to the Permian period, there's a change. There's a complete change in fauna and life on Earth, you know. All of us, you know, and there's, you start seeing, you know, fossils disappearing. You know, when I did a detailed study of, I could take someone out to any layer of rock and I say, okay, you go down to here and you will find seven different species of brachiopods. But there's a gap here, and when you get to here, there's only 3. And there's another gap, and you only got 1 left. Okay, there are periodic extinctions here.
Right, and it's interesting. theories about those extinctions, even,
go ahead,
you know, meteorites and stuff. But I just want to point out something as you were discussing about the 1.5 trillion suns. Scientists weighed all the mass in the Milky Way galaxy, because I was going to ask you. It's mind-boggling. The Milky Way has a mass of 1.5 trillion suns. So, you know, we've been talking about our little planets and all the different processes that it's gone through and why there have been extinctions. And I believe our planet, by those who understand the age of the stars, is about 13.5 or 6 billion years old. And what are your thoughts, though, even about pushing the envelope a little further into the universe when we talk about 1.5 trillion suns? I mean, the possibility for life, because, you know, the sun is an aspect of what's necessary as well, even though you pointed out very astutely about the underwater volcanoes. What are your thoughts about that? And I'm not trying to divert. I'm just trying to expand.
Well, hold, okay. Very good point that you bring. All right, so you would assume each one of those suns had planets. And this is what I'm getting at. So early on in science, physicists believed that, well, then, all right, so if we just, it's basically, I'm walking you through the process of what science has come to, is that is, what's the probability of life existing on all those other galaxies? Well, if all those other suns support a solar system, okay, and that if the planet is the right distance from the sun, it can support life. So there are millions of opportunities for that. But this is what I'm getting at. This is why I'm walking you through this process of extinctions, which is very important because, you know, there's a theory that, and I believe this too, life wants to exist. Okay, so did God create life or did life create itself? You know, they talk about you put the right combination of chemicals together and put a spark in there. You have amino acids, which is the building blocks of life. And that life wants to become complex. We're that it doesn't need God to do this. It's
just, did you know, the Big Bang theory was discovered by a Catholic priest? There have been a lot of wonderful scientists, even in conjunction with Albert Einstein. So I think that irrespective of what this beautiful galaxy and universe is all about, I still think that we come to, like Aristotle talked about, the unmoved mover, the first cause, that there's still a creator, that it doesn't, you know, even with man and woman, you don't just say, I want it, you got to do something, okay, to have a child come into the world. Okay,
all right,
so it doesn't just create itself. So I'm just,
let's save that for, because I want to, I want to get through this, and then we come back.
Okay.
I think it'll be it will follow a logic to come back to that after I get to the point. Okay, so I'm going to work from the premise that life wants to exist. It doesn't need divine inspiration. So I'm going to present that argument. All right. But I'm going to talk about the haphazard chance of life evolving. So, you know, and life wants to evolve to a higher order, to a higher complex order. So if we look at the three eras, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and I'm forgetting what the current era is, you know, that's a problem with getting old. Okay, so the highest order that we achieved during the Paleozoic era was like frogs and lizards, okay? And then in the Mesozoic era, the highest order were these giant dinosaurs, okay? Not mammals.
Mm-hmm.
Mammals were little. You know, mammals were they were the runt of the earth. These are the ones that are basically hiding. And then an asteroid hits, and there's probably, and what we know is lots of asteroids have hit this meteorite,
right.
And asteroids have hit this earth. There's plenty of evidence of that. And they either do a local wipeout of life or they do a global wipeout of life. But life still survives. And then what happens is then comes the age of mammals. And
can we
and
consider the flood in that paradigm or no?
Well, I'm okay. Yes, we could. Well, it would only fit
because
in
of
the
all
it would only fit in
cultures,
first of all
stories.
I believe that the flood flood of the Old Testament was a localized flood, but it could still fit because you're still talking about there are periods of global extinction where only
right.
I mean that okay yeah okay let's back it up. So if you look at the theme of Noah's Ark and the flood, is you have a global catastrophe that happens,
mm-hmm.
and only
right.
a handful of species survive, and from those
right.
species, the
Eight
world
people.
Is repopulated, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we get, so that's a constant theme on the Earth. And we as humans, the most advanced, you know, thinking animals, are the product of this third period. What happens when there's another? Actually, I've heard scientists, you know, who look at these periodic extinctions and said they believe insects will dominate the era. After
mm-hmm.
so the mammals have had their turn, the birds had their turn, the reptiles and amphibians had their turn. So there's these periodic extinctions, mass extinctions, where only fragments of all species survive. But it's the ones who seem to be in the lowest order, the ones who are the most adaptable, are the ones who come out and dominate. And so they're saying the insects fill that role right now. Okay? But here's what I'm getting at. And this is something where they said, like, so any one of those suns to produce life like we know here.
Right.
All right. So
right.
one of the things we're finding out just when we look at the evolution, it's really an accident that we exist. You had to go through several mass extinctions before mammals dominated the Earth. Okay? And when we look at the you know, we don't know really, we're speculating on what wiped out the woolly mammoths and all those, you know, giant mammals, and man becomes the dominant life on Earth after that. But here's what was presented. They said the more we learned about life, the more we and the universe, the more we realize how unique the Earth is. Because here's the thing
mm-hmm.
they found out. So a lot, there's so many factors causing these mass extinctions, all right? You know, vulcanization during the Permian period. But a lot of it was asteroids. And we know, and there's speculation, like, why do these extinctions occur every so many million years? And what they think is there's this huge asteroid field that is floating around the galaxy collide, and we collide, or it's probably two galaxies running into each other or whatever. But they can almost put a timetable on it. But here's the thing. They say the reason life on Earth exists is because we have a planet the size of Jupiter that is such a gravitational magnet. It sucks in most of the debris. And I think that conclusion was drawn when we had this there was this one comet that was floating around that came close to the Earth, and Jupiter just sucked it in, and it literally broke it apart as it got close to Jupiter. And that's when they realized that for life to exist, you know, say, so you can have all these planets. You find that one or two planets that are the right distance from the sun and have, you know, you got to look at not all planets are created equal, you know, what minerals and things like that. So it has all the right conditions. It also needs a Jupiter. It needs a massive planet that is going to attract all the asteroids, draw, you know, it's going to be that bullet magnet that draws away the asteroids, which prevent, you know, because think of like, you know, if every time we just get started on creating complex life, boom, another asteroid meteorite hits us and wipes it all out, we have to start all over again. We would never get to where we are today. So that's what I have found very interesting about, you know, and I can't tell you what the odds are, but what they find is the more they begin to learn about what it takes for life to exist on the Earth, they realize how unique Earth is. So as they look out into the galaxy and they find these sun-like stars, they find these planets, and then they're going, all right, do they meet all these other conditions? So life is very unique on this Earth, okay?
Well, that's why.
So now we can get to the point is, all right, so is this all just a accident of that life wants to exist, or is there some kind of divine influence in this? Here's your chance.
I mean, Scripture talks about how God upholds all things by the power of his word. And as I mentioned earlier about...
Wait. Okay. Before you get that. See, you and I have had this discussion. Word. See, when you say word, that means like the spoken word, just like we are talking
right
now. So God speaks and this happens. Who's God speaking to? But see, when the scriptures refer to, you know, the word, it really refers to the Greek word logos. Logos
right
has a much more complex meaning than the spoken word. So let's start with that. So when you say the word, let's get to the original term that was used, what it means, because I think when we understand logos, then we have a better understanding that God just doesn't speak in life forms. There's a little more complex than that.
God created everything out of nothing. That's a great theological truth. The logos, in the Greek etymological understanding of its root, has something to do with reasoning as well. Logic, okay? It's not just the spoken word. You'll see sometimes people will compare logos with rhema, and they'll try to make a distinction there. But we use that in critical thinking and in logic. And so certainly Christ is called the Word. This is the creative being that working along with God and bringing life into existence out of nothing. And so there is that sense of reason. In other words, it's not just lifeless and doesn't have any intelligibility to it. That's why the creation has so much intelligibility in it, you know, as far as built into it. And that's why when we deduct certain things that you and I are discussing, we can come up with some very reasonable solutions about the order of the universe. We know, Rich, the sun's coming up tomorrow, okay? We know certain seasons are going to take place, and we know it's going to be very, very hot in July, August, and we know that it's going to be a lot cooler, you know, here in Virginia in January, February. I mean, this is the sense. So when we talk about chance, we kind of take away that intelligence that's been built into the universe and the predictability that goes along with it. And I really enjoyed a lot of your stories, and, you know, I've heard theories about the meteorites and so on and so forth and destroying aspects of life. But still, even as we observe, and there might be a more intelligent being apart from the angels than us, but we're pretty incredible, you know, to just happen out of necessity without any intentionality is not really logical. And, you know, what we can do now, we've watched the human species and we haven't grown any wings. We haven't, as a matter of fact, I had a student ask me if he could do a paper on moral evolution. And I said, well, my father was in World War II, was in the Army. I was in Vietnam. My son was in Afghanistan. I said, how are we doing? And I think that we're looking for something, and I understand, you know, billions of years. I've talked to enough scientists, and these are believers. However, there's something discernible about the universe and about the man and woman and about the plant life and about the animals that gives us, as Aristotle, who's one of the greatest minds that ever lived, the sense that there was an unmoved mover, there was a first cause, and that there's, you know, there's a predictability about what's happening even now. We can project about what is going to happen. I remember this atheist cosmologist had me sit in his class all semester, a physics person. He's an atheist. We're good friends. We both lost children. We have that kind of bond. And he began to share some things like you did about how it's all going to end, you know, with the sun and so on and so forth. And I teased him after class. He said, how'd I do? And I said, well, I have to have more faith to believe what you said is going to happen than I, you know, believe from scripture. And he's a good guy. We're still friends. We've debated. He's very astute theologically, knows Thomas Aquinas. And so I just think that when we look at DNA, RNA, when we look at, you know, brain matter and different things of that nature, there's too many things that have been ordered that we can extrapolate and study that breathes of intelligibility and a creator. And so whether or not that is on other planets, that's kind of our, you know, look for this evening. But I think that the Earth didn't create itself. The galaxies, the Milky Way, you know, the universe didn't create itself. And how mind-boggling is it to think of 1.5 trillion suns? I can't even comprehend that.
Well, all right. So for the skeptics out there, so I'm going to present their side of this argument. Well, actually, I'm going to present both sides of it, okay? All right, because we're talking about UFOs. The show is quickly devolving. Okay, so for us to understand the potential of intelligent thinking life on another planet, we have to look at how this life, how humans evolved. And so what scientists believe is for life to exist, you have to have, you know, all the same elements, the building blocks. Life needs water. It feeds on life like we have. It feeds on oxygen. Plant life feeds on sunlight and carbon dioxide. And we think that's universal. Okay, because that's all we know. So we're working from that premise.
And so, propagation, too, Rich. I mean, even the animals, you know what I'm saying?
Wait, what was the word
mechanism.
You used? Right, okay. My point is, so I threw it out that just doesn't happen. I mean, it's like it could go in any direction. No, I believe, you know, for evolutionists, they just believe something inspires life to want to become more complex.
Right.
Now, there's lots of life out there, like jellyfish and stuff, that have no desire to become any smarter than they are. Hey, they got it. Okay. Life is simple. Okay. So, hey, I'm a starfish. All right. Life is simple. Tear me apart, and then they just, you know, regrow this. Okay.
Right.
There was probably a jellyfish goat. You know what? This isn't enough, and I want something better. Or there's a really good book called The Wonderful Life, which talks about the Precambrian Precambrian explosion. That's what it is, the Precambrian edificiary, or the Precambrian explosion. And it really presents the theme that it was all accident. I mean, there was a lot of accidents, right, as to what state families will survive and they will proliferate the earth. Okay, but what you find is the pattern evolution, it always gets more complex. What's driving that force? Okay, convince me that there has to be a divine inspiration to make life want to become more complex.
Or a greater intelligence, okay? I mean, you bring out a very
good point.
No,
let's just talk
point.
Complexity. We're not even to greater intelligence. Let's just talk about that this whole story of evolution coming more complex. If I just look at the first ferns, they're very simple looking ferns.
Right.
And then
right.
you get to ferns today are very ornate and fancy looking. They didn't exist. Life was, I am fascinated by the Permian period. I have a ginkgo tree in front of my yard. I planted it when I got here. It is, there are like, I think four trees that survived the Permian period. The ginkgo tree, the monkey puzzle tree, the recently discovered Wollemi pine, and the Norfolk Island pine. And what's interesting is three of those species came from Australia, and the ginkgo trees from Japan. And the thing about when you look at the ginkgo tree is like you can definitely tell it's a simple tree compared to how the branches evolve on it when you look at the branches on another tree. Because I can sit there, it's in my front yard to look at it. And then Colonial Williamsburg has planted several of them. The story of evolution
taking
is
simplicity,
why it wants to become more complex. Why is there a divine inspiration?
But I think even if you look at one species that then becomes male and female, okay, I mean, when we talk about, I understand the building blocks that you're talking about and complexity, but I don't think that, and depending on your point of view as far as how many millions of years it takes for, you know, this complexity to continue to propagate, I don't think we have seen, as far as recorded history is concerned, maybe 10,000 years, any real evolution of complexity in the Homo sapien species. From all the recorded records we have, you know, and of course I've read other types of civilizations or whatever, but just go with 10,000 years. I don't think that we've seen much. I mean, it's fascinating to look at some of Da Vinci's and even Michelangelo's understanding of the physical body and so on and so forth. And I know there have been physicians that have said, for instance, the appendix is useless and this and that and everything else. But I don't know that theory or hypothesis that takes simplicity and brings it to complexity can really pass the smell test when it comes to the different genders, biologically, and then reproduction and what it takes to reproduce. You know, there's some people who can reproduce and other people who cannot. So it's not that it just it wants to do so, so therefore it does. And so I just think that, you know, understanding what you're saying with the trees and that kind of thing, but I guess what I'm looking to understand or to communicate, because we are talking about higher beings, more intelligent than us, so therefore their technology is superior to ours, and we're freaking out because it's so much faster, or we, you know, it disappears. I mean, all these different things that take place. And I'm just, you know, wondering, you know, if we're speculating a lot more. And certainly there are things we don't know, and there's something about mystery. But I think in the same way as you've shared, I think it's planted in the heart of humans to want to know. And I think we need to keep, you know, searching out until we have real empirical data that's convincing, that's not just hypotheses, but real theory. And, you know, you'll have people who claim, you know, there's no question about this and that. And there are other people who are, I've worked with a lot of scientists, okay, hard science they are, and yet they take a different position. I told you, I took a course at Cambridge in England on science and theology. Now, one thing I'd like to point out to you, Rich, I was part of the Faraday Institute in Cambridge, England. Now, the Faraday Institute is where doctors and all kinds of scientists come for the theological degrees. The UK doesn't have the dichotomy like we do. You either believe in science or you believe in God. They don't have that dichotomy. The person, and I've met with him, Sir John Polkinghorne, I've served mass with him, I've been in his home. He was the master of Queen's College, a quantum physicist, and now he's an Anglican priest. I know him personally. I've been in, and so we make this big dichotomy like be an intelligent believer and be scientific. These guys know so much more than you and I ever will about science. I spoke with a physicist yesterday. He's got a PhD from MIT, and he was thrilled that he went to this particular meeting that had to do with zoning, that they prayed. And he shared with me, we've got to look beyond what we can understand, the mystery.
Yeah, this division between science and religion is not the only thing unique to America academic. History is another one. In the history field, there is division between the academics and everybody else, and everybody else is lumped into public history, and the academics look down on the public historians. I fit in the category of the public historians. I was, you know, as a military historian, I deployed downrange to collect, you know, information that people are going to study later on. In fact, before I drove home back to Oklahoma, I attended a history conference, and the most interesting panel discussion that I attended was one about the need to create an oral history program for the Army National Guard, which is like something I did for my own branch, and these guys were in the infancy of it, and I like shared with them everything I did. I said, like, here's everything I did, guys, and here's what you're going to run into. And one of the things you're going to run into is not everybody shares your same passion for this subject. You may understand the importance of it, but not everybody. But my point being is, in the terms of, like, physics, there is no division between the professors and the lab researchers. In fact, they collaborate, but there is very little collaboration between the academic historians and what I will call field historians, those of us who are out there, you know, doing the field research. So So it's very interesting that in Europe, they don't separate religion from science. But here we do.
Nope.
But anyway, what I was going to get at is, well, Father Michael, you failed to convince me, the skeptic, that I have not heard anything convincing that there is a divine influence in it. Because I'm going to look at this and I say, I think it's all accidental as who came out on top. Because we've gone through three eras, and man is only the culmination of the third era. The first era was frogs, lizards, and salamanders, and then we have these dinosaurs, and everybody's fascinated with dinosaurs. I mean, come on, man could not exist during the period of dinosaurs. Now, in my earlier understanding of evolution, I believe that God had to wipe out dinosaurs for man to exist. I'm going to be straight up on that. But you,
man, is the crown of creation.
You started talking about how long Homo sapiens have been on the earth, and I think it's been about 100,000 years, not a million years, 100,000 years,
mm-hmm.
And
okay.
They only start having evidence of tool making maybe 30,000-40,000 years ago. It was about, I can't think, 6 to 10,000 years ago, the man started farming and building villages, okay? Homo sapiens didn't change. I believe the environment changed that caused them to have to change the way they did business. They went from hunter-gatherers to farmers and shepherds, okay, managers of livestock. All right. But we are only a fraction of a second on the geological time clock that's been ticking for 5 billion years. Okay. What makes us so special? Because we can think, we're rational. But here's the issue. This is what I'm going to throw out. Okay. So what was the purpose of divine, or let me ask you, okay, I'll ask you that, and we're running close to the end of the show, so I hope you can get to an answer quick. All right. So what's the purpose of divine inspiration for life? Was it to create man, which only represents a fraction of a second on the geological time clock? What was the purpose of divine inspiration for life?
Humans are the crown of creation. You know, even in the creation story, and, you know, we're not saying it's a scientific story, but this atheist I told you, the scientist, this cosmologist, told me that the order of Genesis is accurate. He doesn't believe in
it
God.
He doesn't believe
in the Bible.
It is. Absolutely.
And so the crown of creation is humanity. And so, yes, we are the apple of God's eye. God loves the animals. You remember in Jonah, and you know, when the Jews make atonement every year, they read Jonah because of God's mercy. God cared about the 125,000 people who didn't know right from wrong, and he also cared about the animals. The Bible says that a righteous person has regard for his or her beast. However, there's a distinction. We are the only ones in creation that are made in the image and likeness of God. And that's why, you know, Jesus came as God to save us. And so, however the process was that God used, the crown of creation is humanity. And so everything in one essence has been made for us. Now, we should be taking care of the earth better as environmentalists. We should be not enslaving people. We shouldn't be cruel to animals. But there's no question that we were made for ruling, for dignity, for kingship, to be vice regents of who God is, with our dignity and our elegance and our ability to reason. And so, yes, it was all done, and irrespective of how long it was done, you know, it's just like, you know, you build a deck and you do all this other, you know, preparatory work. But the real goal is to get the family out there with the grill, with the nice umbrella, with the chairs. She went through a whole process. And you say, this is why we went through that process. It was for my family. And I think the same is true for humankind.
Okay. I think the barbecue analogy won me over. Okay. Now, here's my thing. So God created life so we could have barbecues. However, when you look at the geological clock, that dinosaur, I mean, when you look at how long man in his current form has been and how long he's been having barbecues, when we got the dinosaurs, I think God was having fun. He's like, I am seriously entertained right now. Let's let this play out for several million years, okay? But the thing is, if man is a culmination of life, then God has to wipe out dinosaurs. Okay, now here's what I'm getting at. Okay, so the show is not about evolution, but UFOs, which means there has to be alien forms of life out there that is of a higher intelligence than we are, then evolution of man continues. But here's the issue. So if there was no divine inspiration, as you said, the purpose of divine inspiration is to create this intelligent being, us. Then if life exists on other galaxies, these other solar systems,
right,
then the purpose, God exists and God is universal, then the purpose, the divine purpose, is to create this intelligent being that is created in God's image, and that these aliens that people describe that are bigger heads, weaker bodies, and big eyes, they are another evolution of mankind. This is the direction that we are going, right? So for that to happen, actually, I think, supports this belief of a divine inspiration. The creation of all life is to get us to this point.
Right, and it's really interesting because we keep calling them aliens. They might be another species. You know what I'm saying? They're aliens because, you know, we throw that word around a lot, you know, with all that's going on at the border and this and that.
Yep.
And, you know, it's alien to us, but maybe we're alien to them. And,
well, we are.
You know, who? Yeah. Right. Yeah. But maybe they know more about us.
But none of us are alien to God, if God is the inspiration behind all life. Okay, guess what? Guess who finally got home? Yeah, I thought he was supposed to pull in the home 30 minutes into the show. Go ahead, James.
No, I've been listening. Actually, I was listening going down the road, and it was really, you know, the fact is that there's something that people are seeing. We've seen the videos. I think I sent you both gentlemen a video that came in about the U.S. Navy ship. I think it was the USS Oklahoma or something. I can't remember. But anyway, it was so interesting and fascinating to see that. Now, like Rich says, we're not skeptics as much as we are, you know, we're really like military analysts, you know, we're like intel analysts. We look at it. We first look at it and say, okay, can the enemy be doing this? Is this Russia, China, Iran, blase, blase? And then, you know, our faith side of us comes in because we also know that, you know, that there are angels and there are things that we see that we don't always understand. And, of course, there are, you know, evil things that are out there as well. You know, are these things evil? Are they wicked? Are they bad? So there's many questions, and people are looking for answers. And with this day and age being so technologically advanced, I mean, everybody's got a cell phone. They can catch a picture. And I'm going to tell you, I've seen things that I could not explain that went across the sky, especially when I was overseas in Iraq where you had no light pollution and you could just see for miles, you know, forever. It seemed like beautiful stars, too, by the way. A great place to be.
Oh, James, let me interrupt you. Oh, my God, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I have not seen so many stars in the sky since I was a little kid growing up in Oklahoma. Yeah. I mean, I have never seen the Milky Way since I left. I mean,
yeah.
Because as you point out, the light pollution, we don't see those. Yeah. I mean, I love Afghanistan. The problem with Iraq, with the exception of Scania, they had all those floodlights on all the things. Scania, they didn't have the light, and you could sit there and
sure.
Afghanistan. I loved Afghanistan. I would go out and find a place and just lay down and stare at the stars, and I miss that. Anyway, you just triggered one of my wonderful memories of deploying overseas.
Well,
okay,
and I can tell you that, you know, as both a young NCO, very new NCO, and as a junior officer, you know, I was involved in two different 15-6 investigations. One was very bizarre and strange, and I'll have to tell you about it. We don't have time to go into it, but it has to do with a soldier that saw a ghost. And this soldier, you know, it was during Operation Reforger. And, Rich, I think I might have told you this once before about the friend of mine that woke up, and there was an SS soldier, you know, he said that was standing at the foot of his bed. And, you know, we were all in those barracks right outside of Hohenfels and Hoff, if you remember those, and Grafenwehr. Some of these barracks were old Nazi SS barracks.
Some were old SS barracks, but they were all former Wehrmacht barracks. Yeah.
Well, yeah, this one was an SS barracks in particular, and he was waking up. He was woke up by a guy dressed in all SS gear, and he was yelling at him in German, and it terrified him, you know. And, of course, it got all around, and the commander says, well, we're going to do an investigation. We're going to find out what really happened. Was somebody horsing around, you know, dressing up like a ghost or whatever? And nobody could explain it, Rich. Now, that was one thing. The other thing was a UFO sighting. And that was down at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And it was so – because it was called in. We used to do guard duty on the motor pool, if y'all remember, motor pool guard. And a guy called in something that he saw, this hovering aircraft. It was just – you know, it just didn't know what it was. And we thought it was something from Hunter Army Airfield. And, well, nobody can explain. So those are two things that I've personally been involved in that I can clearly tell you, it's not classified, nothing, you know, was bad about either one of them, but we never could explain it. We just had to just take what the soldier said as the truth. They saw something, they saw what they said they saw, and no one could explain it. So I do think that there are things out there that are hard to explain. I do believe that that there is good and evil too. So I believe that there is a, you know, a malevolence that can, you know, like I don't see anything good that would appear as a former SS officer. I'm sorry. I don't think I could see that. And the guy that saw that is a good friend of mine. I still talk to him to this day. You know, he was terrified by that experience. He really was. So we might even be able to get him on the show, and that would be good.
Well, we should have had him on the show when we're talking about goats. Okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do another.
Because yeah, we'll
but I'm going to do a public speaking event at the Mothman during the Mothman weekend. in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is in September. In Point Pleasant, West Virginia, look it up, the Mothman Festival. But I have been asked to be a guest speaker, and they want to get my view of UFOs and, you know, the view from a military perspective. And why does everyone think that the military is hiding stuff? And I don't think that the military is intentionally hiding anything. They just can't explain it.
Right. So that's how I started off the show. Is yeah, I think like the military. I am very open minded. I believe there is a potential for life on other planets, and that they could be vented. And I believe there's a potential for higher forms of life. Okay, but to believe that, you have to believe, you know, the fact that life would evolve the same way or to the same point throughout the universe would have to admit there's some singular source that wants it to do so. Okay? But the thing is, just because you've seen something you can't explain doesn't validate that it comes from another world. That is what... You know, my position, your position, is the same as the military's position. We can't explain it, and we're not going to draw any conclusions. You know, you may want to say that it's from another world, but you know what? The Soviets and the Chinese could be more technically advanced because all these sightings are appearing over a military bases, and they'd be spying on us. Okay?
Sure, absolutely.
That's the common pattern we're fighting. But
you're right.
But the thing is, sightings of aliens, okay. And I think that's kind of like where we digress is when we look at the little green men, you know, big heads, big eyes, little wimpy bodies. Okay, that is a pattern. Why is that a pattern? It's a pattern of evolution. Go ahead.
But amazingly strong. Anybody that's ever confronted that, they've said that they looked weak, but they were amazingly strong. I mean, like inhumanly strong, just crazy strong.
The only cases, I'm not familiar with physical contact with them, except in space. That's where they, like when they get abducted and they're taken in the air, in the spacecraft, they're taken into zero gravity. Yeah,
sure.
They're amazingly strong because they're used to operating in zero gravity where everybody else isn't. I haven't heard of cases, but I don't pay a whole lot of it. When I was younger, I read a lot of stuff on it.
Sure.
I don't now. Okay, all right.
Okay,
I haven't heard of a case on Earth gravity where these aliens have been able to manhandle somebody.
We've only got. I want you to take on an alien using your Aikido techniques. We're gonna see how.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Jane. That's what I was going to say. If they had super Herbian power, okay, what is
right.
Aikido? Aikido is not a throw. It's not a joint manipulation. It's about blending your movements with your opponent's movements, natural movements, and using it against them. And so when you say they have superhuman powers, and I look at they don't have any muscles, well, they're not using their muscles. They're so advanced that they're doing Aikido. They're actually they feel your weaknesses, how your body moves, and they manipulate you accordingly. Okay, so I want to meet one. I want to meet one and actually spar with one. Okay,
close it down, old buddy. It's just like 30 seconds before or a minute before it shuts down.
All right. Okay. Hey guys. I'll go ahead and look. Kill Blaine, KILOBLANE. Look up some of my books on Amazon. I've got a new book coming out. Don't know when it's going to be published on the Rough Riders. Father Michael Patella, Church of. Go ahead. Tell them your Facebook page if anybody wants to
Saint
follow
Michael's
you.
CEC.org. And St. Michael's and All Angels, it's Williamsburg, Virginia.
Okay, guys, I'm just going to tell you a quick shout-out. If you listen to his sermon on Sunday, it's like a college class versus a elementary class when I go to any other church, okay? All right. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Bless.